From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm John Wells.
Over the past 6 years on Cool Science Radio, Lynn and I have spoken with a number of technology companies that have been advised, supported, and initially financed by venture capitalists. Today, we have the opportunity to speak with Scott Cooper, who's the managing partner at Andreessen Horowitz. It's one of the Silicon Valley's most successful venture capitalists. In addition to being managing partner, where he's overseen the firm's growth to 150 employees and $7 billion in assets, he's also the co-founder and co-director of the Stanford Venture Capital Directors College, and he teaches venture capital and corporate governance courses at Stanford Law School and the Haas School of Business and Bolt School of Law at UC Berkeley. Scott has just written Secrets of Sand Hill, Venture Capital and How to Get It. Scott, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks, John. Thanks, Lynn. Great to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. You know, Scott, there's a misconception by those that have not had experience with venture capitalists that venture capitalists find a promising investment and simply write a check. Can you take us through the range of involvement that venture capitalists may take with their investments during the entrepreneurial life cycle?
Yeah, it's a really good point. A lot of what the venture capitalists do, of course, you know, we provide capital for things, but really a lot of what we try to do is to help the entrepreneur realize the vision of their business. And that might be anything from sitting on the board of the company and hopefully helping guide them, you know, by being a member of the board. But, you know, in a lot of cases, and in particular how we do things here at Andreessen Horowitz, it means helping them with sales opportunities and helping them with PR and marketing, making sure they're hiring the right people and get access to the best talent. So we really try to be, quite frankly, a partner all along the way of the growth curve of the business.
And how long will venture capitalists and founders have a relationship on average?
Yeah, it's pretty long. So it used to be that, you know, companies would be around for about 6 or so years, and then they would often go public, and that would be kind of typically the time where the venture capitalist would step off. Today, it's more like 10 to 12 years, and I wrote this in the book somewhat jokingly, but you know, it actually lasts, quite frankly, longer than the average marriage in the U.S., which unfortunately only lasts about 8 years. So you know, your venture capital relationship is likely to last longer, unfortunately, than most marriages.
Scott, your book is titled Secrets of Sand Hill Road, and if you look up Sand Hill Road on Google Maps, you learn that, wow, it is in the hotbed of the technology, technology companies of Silicon Valley. Can you take us there to Sand Hill and tell us a little bit about it geographically and what exists there?
Yeah, sure. So Sand Hill is actually kind of in Menlo Park, California, which is probably most famous for its neighbor about a mile and a half down the road, which is Stanford University. If you come to Sand Hill, you will probably be disappointed by the fact that it's basically just a collection of relatively low-slung buildings. There's nothing geographically that exciting about it. But to your point, it really has represented the epicenter of financing. And I think a lot of that has to do with its proximity to Stanford. Stanford really, since its origin, has really done a great job of having professors go, you know, from academia into industry and lots of different technology that comes out. And so that's really, I think, why we've all ended up here. Interestingly, over time, San Francisco is really becoming kind of more of the center now of Silicon Valley, and it's about 30 miles to the north of Sand Hill. So if we have this conversation in 30 years from now, it'll be interesting to see whether Sand Hill Road is still the same epicenter or whether San Francisco really has overtaken it.
I think it was last week or the week before we spoke with Margaret O'Mara, who has written a book called The Code about the history of Silicon Valley and how it developed around these tech companies. A great book. But, you know, she points out, as do you in your book, about how venture capital really has funded the huge tech companies that we think of: Facebook, Cisco, Apple, Amazon, Google, Netflix. And I think where the genesis of your book was really answering some questions for investors, venture capitalists, entrepreneurs, innovators, the same questions that you were getting over and over about venture capital. What were some of those questions?
Yeah, we've been in this business for about 10 years now, and a lot of the questions really, most of them come from entrepreneurs, and most of them focus around very fundamental questions like, you know, for example, is venture capital even the right form of financing for the kind of business that I'm trying to build? you know, if you live here in Silicon Valley, of course, you know, it's front and center in the newspaper all the time. And so, you know, it's probably not a question that a lot of people think about. But, you know, venture capital is not necessarily the right form of capital for people, for all businesses. And then a lot of the questions were really about how do I most effectively work with a venture capitalist to make sure that, quite frankly, I don't get taken advantage of and can achieve the business goal that I set out to, which was hopefully to build a big, enduring, important company like many of the companies that you mentioned.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Scott Cooper. He's the managing partner at Andreessen Horowitz. It's one of Silicon Valley's most successful venture capitalists. Scott, I wanted to ask you, how did your experience at LoudCloud inform your experience today as a venture capitalist and get you involved in all of this?
Yeah, for those people who don't know about it, LoudCloud was a company that was started in 1999. And the goal of the business was really to build what today, quite frankly, has become what Amazon Web Services does. So the idea being that compute should be something that ought to be a utility and accessible to lots of people without having to know and understand all the complexity behind it. And as with a lot of things in venture capital, it was a great idea that was probably about maybe 10 years ahead of its time. I think the biggest lesson that we took away from that was building a business, not surprisingly, is incredibly tough and incredibly challenging. We started in 1999, which you'll recall was kind of the peak of the dot-com, market. But very quickly, the market turned, and so we went from a very big growth business to, unfortunately, a business where we had to reduce our headcount. We had to kind of really constrain resources. And I think what it shows you, and certainly what I took away from it, was you really have a real deep sense of empathy for how difficult it is to build a company, how much entrepreneurs, quite frankly, put their entire, life into these things, and that, so much of this is timing and execution and certainly some element of luck that that allows some of these companies to ultimately get to the finish line.
Yeah, absolutely, and luck certainly does play a role. And, sure. People see folks driving fancy cars, living in fancy houses, and they just think, man, company went public and that's all you've got to do. But the infant mortality is probably about 10% or less than 10%, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Most of what we do, the reality of venture is most of what we do, unfortunately, doesn't turn out to be a very good investment or a very good business. So in our business, about 50% of the investments we make will either lose all of our money or probably most of the money that we invested. Mm-hmm. And then maybe 20 to 30% of the businesses, you'll make a little bit of money. And it turns out that the difference between success or failure as a venture capitalist is a function of what does that last 10 to 20% of businesses look like. So do you ultimately get something like a Facebook or a Google or an Amazon that obviously can, return a tremendous amount of investment to your investors? And if you don't really have companies like that in your portfolio, quite frankly, it's very hard to make the business work.
Right. But from 40,000 feet, when you look at the entire industry, there's, I believe, 665 public companies, according to Eric Ries, who wrote in your book. He also said, and this is fascinating, that venture-backed companies now spend 44% of the entire R&D budget for American public companies, and that the 665 public companies that are VC-backed make up a fifth of total market capitalization of public companies that employ 4 million people. So there's the Facebooks, the Googles, the Apples, but there are a lot of other smaller companies we have not heard of that are really driving our economy, aren't there?
Yeah, that to me is the most exciting thing about kind of the role that, we all get to play in this ecosystem is so much of kind of the economic growth and productivity growth that happens in the U.S. is a function of, a lot of these entrepreneurs who are, have a vision and, kind of start with one or two or three people, and ultimately they employ people, they spend money on R&D, they obviously consume resources and services in local communities. And to me, this is such a tremendous engine of growth for the economy, and we've been a huge beneficiary in the U.S. of this. And one of the things that obviously, we hope and aspire for our industry is that over time, the U.S. continues to be a very attractive place for, really innovative entrepreneurs to continue to build these businesses. Because, if we do so, this really, I think, is the key to continuing to unlock economic growth for, hopefully many future generations.
Scott, of course, as you're talking about, the byproduct of these large tech companies is the existence of many creative entrepreneurs and innovation. And you see it in Silicon Valley, and you also see it here in Utah. I'm sure you're familiar with the term Silicon Slopes and the you know, the springing forth from companies like Overstock and SanDisk and Adobe of these small startups. So when you are in venture capital, what are some of the things that you're looking for when you're trying to decipher whether a startup is going to be something you even want to focus on for a moment to even understand what it is they're trying to monetize?
Yeah, so the way we kind of think about evaluating opportunities is the place we usually start is we try to get a sense for how big is the market opportunity that the company's going after. And if you think about kind of what we talked about earlier, that most of our companies unfortunately don't work, we really need to find a few companies that ultimately can be very, very big. And so kind of our first, you know, kind of criteria is, okay, if everything goes well and this entrepreneurial team executes as they say they're going to do, can this ultimately sustain a big company? And today, big company probably means something that can go public, which means it probably has a couple billion-dollar market cap opportunity in front of it. And then, you know, the honest answer is beyond that, most of what we're evaluating is the team. We're really trying to figure out, okay, if it's an interesting opportunity, why is this team most uniquely suited to go after the opportunity? What is it that they know that maybe other people don't? You know, how did they kind of, you know, come about this secret and, you know, earn the knowledge they have about this industry? Because so much of these businesses then will ultimately be around kind of, you know, excellence in execution around what we hope is a very big market idea.
So many of these tech innovators know about tech. They don't know about business. That's where this hand-holding comes in from the venture capital. And so I think that your book is written as much for those types of people as they are those who are looking to invest in technology or anything else, really. What are the tips that you give to people like this that have a great idea, who are just getting going? What are the first things that they do?
Yeah, so first of all, you're absolutely right, which is a lot of kind of the individuals that we back tend to be very kind of engineering product-centric people because, you know, ultimately, obviously, a lot of this business is innovation around product. But I think where we can be helpful and the advice we try to give them is that it turns out, at least in our experience, that you know, there's some companies, of course, that don't succeed because the product just never takes in the market. But there's probably, quite frankly, many more instances of failure where we see companies that actually have a good idea and a good product, but they just don't execute in the way that allows them to win. And often that means everything from kind of what's the culture of your company, how do you hire people, how do you make sure that you are kind of always pushing the envelope on bringing in the right people in the organization who can help you kind of round out the experiences and the skill sets that you may not have. And so a lot of what we end up doing, and, you know, we shouldn't kid ourselves, the entrepreneurs, of course, are doing the hard work here, but a lot of our job is really to kind of hopefully identify these issues up front and just encourage the entrepreneurs to make sure that they are kind of scaling and growing and progressing with the business side of things, as well as they progress, obviously, with the product and engineering sides of the business.
Scott, you're developing a product that uniquely addresses a strong market. You've met with your lawyer about tax and governance. You've started a C corporation. You've determined you want to raise some money from a VC. You contact your first VC. You set up your first meeting. And now you need to pitch your company.
Yeah.
How, you know, why is the pitch so important? What goes into the pitch and how do you put it together and make it happen?
Yeah, well, it's incredibly important, you know, because it is obviously a lot of the basis on which venture capitalists ultimately make decisions. And the way I would say, the best advice I would give to an entrepreneur is understand kind of the incentives that drive the VC and then think about how does what you're doing actually fit in with that. So, again, we talked a little bit about how the business works, which is we are looking for things that have hopefully the opportunity to have tremendously uncapped upside. And we also recognize, you know, as I said, too, that most of these things won't work. So that's okay. We're not afraid of the prospect of failure of the businesses. And so the way to orient your pitch is really to address those issues. So why is this market so important and so big that it kind of needs a company? Why are you and your co-founders the absolute right people to execute on this business? You know, tell us about your background. Tell us about how you came to the idea. Tell us about how it kind of organically developed into a company. And then ultimately, we want to know some of the specifics around, okay, how are you going to sell the product? How are you going to develop the product? How are you going to learn from customers and incorporate all the information you need And all of those things really kind of go into the kind of, you know, locus of information that a VC is going to want to know to decide, is this one of those 8 or 10 or 12 bets in my portfolio that at least has the prospect to be able to be one of those very large businesses?
And maybe the product's under development. It hasn't come out yet. They haven't sold anything, obviously.
Sure.
So if it's an engineering type person that may be a little bit on the analytical side, they need to tell a story. They need to tell a compelling story, and they may be uncomfortable doing that.
Yeah. No, look, storytelling, as I talk about in the book, is an incredibly important skill set in this business. And if you think about it, you know it from the environment you live in as well. You know, employees have lots of opportunities. It's a very tight labor market. And so your ability to tell a story to compel people to go do something that in some cases might seem irrational. So I should go quit my job to come work for you when all you have is an idea and a product. It almost sounds crazy in some respect. But it's the ability of you to articulate that story, to help them understand the vision, to help get customers who, quite frankly, you know, also it's very risky for new customers to, you know, kind of take on new products. And so you've got to be able to kind of articulate why it is that what you're building is so important that people should do things that, you know, in many respects are irrational for them to do. So a lot of what, you know, we try to help our companies do and, you know, what really sets apart great entrepreneurs is their ability to tell that compelling story in a way that really allows them to kind of lead a set of people towards an incredible objective.
So I've told my story. I've mastered my pitch. As an entrepreneur and an innovator, I've got a lot of ownership over my idea. Now I have to decide whether or not I want people to have an equity position in my company or if I just want to take on debt. And I bet this is a big question for those who are in that position where they're maybe unwilling to share their idea.
Yeah.
In an equity way.
It's true. You're right. So kind of the trade-off you're making if you take venture capital is you're absolutely right, which is number one is you're going to sell equity. So somebody's going to have, you know, an ownership interest in the company that you're starting. And you're also going to kind of, you know, invite somebody into the governance of the business as well. So oftentimes the venture capitalists will go on the board and therefore they will have a say in how you think about, you know, kind of the future of the business. You're absolutely right, which is, you know, an alternative, if you don't like that, would be to raise debt, right? So you could get a loan from either a bank or sometimes you can get a loan from other investors. And I think the real way to think about it as a business is the ultimate goal, of course, I think for most entrepreneurs is they want to win the market, right? They have an idea, they have a vision, and the goal is how can I most effectively achieve that vision? And so I think the real question for entrepreneurs is the trade-off of taking equity from somebody and having them involved in the board, do you think that actually kind of enables you to hopefully achieve the goal that you have in a more positive way and or maybe a faster way and win the market? And if so, then I think most people find that trade-off makes sense. But if not, then yes, something like debt is a great, you know, form of capital. The thing to think about debt, of course, is you ultimately have to pay it back, obviously, to the bank or whatever institution. And so you have to make sure the business can ultimately support that in the sense that it can get to enough of a financial generating business where you have the flexibility to pay back the money and it doesn't compromise your ability to grow or sustain the business over time.
Yeah. Something that's coming to light for me in this conversation is the extent to which a venture capital company and someone like yourself would learn so much and so much depth and complexity in these markets in the various companies that you must do a huge amount of research on. Does it feel like you're getting like a mini master's degree in every area that you're going into because you really have to know so much about it?
Yeah, this is one of the most fun parts of this job is, you know, you spend a day in Silicon Slopes or you spend a day in Sand Hill Road and you really kind of, you know, listen to what these entrepreneurs are doing. And, you know, 99 times out of 100, if not more than that, you walk out and you're kind of left scratching your head, just amazed at what people are building, what they're aspiring to grow and do with their lives. And it's amazing. And you're absolutely right, which is, you know, at some level, all of these things can sound alike. And so I think the difference between, you know, successful VCs and others who, you know, may not be as successful is the, you know, how deep can you get on these technologies? How deep can you understand the markets in a way that you can really kind of pick what look like a set of fantastic companies, but also you have to pick one or two to really kind of focus your time on. So, yeah, it's a real privilege to be in this industry. And, you know, again, you know, it's hard not to be optimistic about the future of the country and the future of our economic growth when you see the types of things that entrepreneurs are focused on.
I guess your knowledge goes a wee bit deeper than that of a radio host who has to learn about this stuff for about an hour.
I hope so. I hope we have more time than that certainly to do it. But and obviously we are, putting real dollars and cents behind some of these decisions. So we've got an obligation to our investors to make sure we're doing that for sure.
And your industry can be fairly specialized, where some people are just involved in angel investing, or maybe get involved in the first round, or don't want to carry the first round. They always want to work with other partners and that sort of thing. Tell us about Andreessen Horowitz and the range of types of investments that you get involved in.
Yeah, so we are what we call a multi-stage firm. So we will do anything from kind of seed level, which, these days might be $1 million investment, up through kind of, a B round, a kind of second financing round, which often can be $15 or $20 million. And then we also have what we call a later stage opportunity fund, which allows us to invest, as much as $50 or $100 or even $150 million into a company that might be already working and that's really looking to kind of, raise expansion capital to grow to a new market or go to a new geography. So we kind of cover the gamut of the ranges. And then we're also kind of, cover a variety of industries. So a lot of what we do, you would recognize as traditional consumer businesses like a Facebook or an Instacart or, Airbnb. We also do a lot of enterprise businesses where, kind of you're selling software into an enterprise. We had a company, Slack, recently that went public that many people may know about in the enterprise space. And then we also have a focus on life sciences. And then lastly, we have a new effort around what we call crypto-related technology. So I'm sure many people have heard of things like Bitcoin and Ethereum. We're investing in companies that are really trying to kind of use this distributed platform architecture to build hopefully really new and exciting businesses.
Yeah, I think the underlying technology of blockchain is really really going to solve some tremendous problems. I'm looking forward to seeing that, continue with, as it works into the market. Are you working with a lot of blockchain companies?
We are, yeah. So we raised a fund specifically focused on this area about a year and a half ago, and we're doing exactly that, which is we're very interested in entrepreneurs who are saying, hey, blockchain is a really interesting way to, it's a technology platform, and how can we make that platform, available to lots of different, engineers and entrepreneurs who might want to build products and services on top of that platform. So, yeah, we're very excited about it. It's still, obviously, as you can imagine, a very nascent industry, but one that we think, venture capital is perfect for this, which is we understand the risks. We know that a lot of these companies, may not ultimately be successful, but we think there can, we can generate some very, very large and self-sustaining businesses in that area.
And limited partners would invest in that fund?
That's correct. Yeah. So we raise that fund from the same types of limited partners that we've raised our prior fund. So often these are, university endowments. Often they are foundations or other organizations who are viewing venture capital as a portion of the assets that they invest. So it's often a relatively small portion on a percentage basis, but they're looking towards their venture capital investment as a way to really drive hopefully very high returns and help them achieve their overall financial goals.
Yeah, I think your book really appeals to a number of different groups. It certainly appeals to those interested in the world, just curious about the world of entrepreneurs and venture capitalists, but it also appeals to entrepreneurs that need to raise capital in the future, and they may want to see what their options are and how VCs think and that sort of thing, but also for people that want to invest in your funds, the limited partners. And, I think there are a lot of people that would be interested in getting this. It's a bit of a primer, but at the same time, it's just fascinating because it goes into all the moving pieces of this relationship.
Well, I appreciate that. And, yeah, that's exactly the goal. The goal was hopefully to kind of make it accessible to anybody who wants to start a business and anybody, quite frankly, as you mentioned, who really just wants to understand the role that technology plays in our broader ecosystem, because it's such a critical foundation of so much of the, opportunity set that we've been, privileged to be a part of here in the U.S. So I appreciate the feedback, and obviously I hope your listeners find it a useful resource.
Scott, I just have a final question, and it does kind of go back to geography. I like geography.
Yeah.
Sand Hill Road, you talked a few minutes ago about a visit to Silicon Valley or a visit to Silicon Slopes. And so I'm wondering about a venture capital company like Andreessen Horowitz. How far out do you look? I mean, you How often do you look to Utah and look at some of the startups here?
Yeah, so we have, if you look at our portfolio today, probably about two-thirds to three-quarters of our portfolio is around Silicon Valley. And some of that is just a function of the fact that we are very actively engaged in our company. So obviously kind of the farther away we are, the harder it is for us to obviously stay, you know, incredibly well plugged into the businesses. But, you know, Utah clearly is a very exciting area. We spend time in places like Seattle and Los Angeles. And so there are certainly pockets like we've seen in Utah where there's tremendous kind of confluence of activity. And, you know, increasingly we are spending more time in geographies like that. So one of the things that I think we will see over the next, hopefully, 10 to 20 years is that the success that places like Utah and other markets have had will extend more broadly across the U.S. And so I'd love to see areas in the Midwest and other places that historically have been underrepresented, quite frankly, in technology benefit from, you know, a lot of the things that have made the markets that you know, you and I live in really, really, you know, valuable.
Scott, before we let you go, I wanted to touch on something that you had mentioned earlier in our conversation, which kind of alludes to venture capitalists with the best batting average don't necessarily make the best VCs. You're not looking for a scrappy short fielder that can hit 260. You're looking for Mark McGuire's. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, that's a great analogy. Yeah, so the way this business works is, as I mentioned, kind of you're exactly right, which is, look, if you can hit singles or doubles, there's nothing wrong with that, but it's very hard for this business ultimately to work financially if you have a lot of those, because so much, unfortunately, of what we do will end up with strikeouts, basically, right? We will end up losing our money a lot, just to continue the analogy. So, yes, you're exactly right. What we want is people who aspire to try to hit a home run, even though we know that they will strike out very often. And, you know, ultimately, we hope that, you know, one or two of the companies out of 10 really can actually achieve that. And, you know, that's the way this business works. It's very hard to be risk-averse in this business and assume that you can make it work. You really have to be constantly looking for each opportunity to at least aspire to get to that outcome, even though we know, unfortunately, that, you know, kind of strikeouts is just, you know, part of the nature of this business.
Scott Cooper is managing partner at Andreessen Horowitz. He oversees the firm's rapid growth all the way up to 150 employees and $7 billion in assets. He also does a good bit of teaching. He's co-founder and co-director of Stanford Venture Capital Directors College, teaches venture capital corporate governance courses at Stanford Law School and the Haas School of Business and the Bolt School of Law at UC Berkeley. You sound like a busy person.
I try to keep busy, but I feel I'm having a lot of fun and really enjoy what I'm doing.
And then finally, he has just written Secrets of Sand Hill Road, Venture Capital and How to Get It. Scott, we want to thank you for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you, John, and thanks, Lynn.
Thanks, Scott.
Okay.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. If you missed part of the show or you want to share it, all our shows are posted within the hour on kpcw.org. Under the Shows tab.
We also podcast all of KPCW's Public Affair Hour shows wherever you find your podcasts, so you can find them under KPCW and the individual show name.
So look for KPCW Cool Science Radio and take us with you on your next road trip or commute.